This is On Location. I'm Tim Leitner. Today's program comes to you from Washington and California. But first, On Location is produced by the NCA Communications Committee with special production assistance from Joe Mamlin and me. You can find our podcast on iTunes, Anchor, Spotify, Google Podcast, Breaker, iHeartRadio, and Radio Public, among others. So subscribe today on your favorite podcast service and tell all your friends. Today's program comes to you from the Northwest and Pacific Coasts, Washington, and California. Join Veronica Riley, Veronica Riley Training and Consulting in California, as she has a conversation with Renee Smith, founder and CEO of A Human Workplace in Washington. Get to know Renee and learn about her unwavering advocacy for love in the workplace. Listen as they discuss what led Renee to this work and how to make work more human. It's going to be a great show, so stick around, and we'll be right back.
Welcome to another edition of the NCA On Location podcast. I'm Veronica Riley. Today, I'm talking with Renee Smith, founder and CEO of A Human Workplace. Renee is a writer, speaker, researcher, teacher, and leader of the movement to make work more loving and human. She has degrees in both organizational behavior and organizational development, and she's worked with public and private sector agencies, large and small, in the United States and abroad. Renee's unwavering advocacy for love in the workplace is changing how we think about and do our jobs, one heart at a time. So let's get into it. Welcome, Renee. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's so good to see you, Veronica. Glad to be here.
So glad to have you. So what is it exactly that led you to this work?
So I was working in government. I was working in Washington state government, and my area of responsibility was building a culture for continuous improvement in government and for lean practices to be adopted to help make government experiences better for Washingtonians, essentially. And we were doing that work in all kinds of ways. It was really energetic and fun, and we were learning a ton of things and came to realize that in order to do that work, in order to have people speak up and point out problems and share ideas and like experiment and find out if their improvement would work and all those things, in order to do that, they had to not be afraid. They had to like feel comfortable. They had to feel safe to do those things. And it became really clear, and I had a conversation with a leader, Chris Liu, and like we got really clear together, like, yeah, it's a leader's job to make sure that the workplace isn't fearful, that it's a safe kind of environment. And actually, we just he named fear. You know, we've got to eliminate that fear. And that was catalyzing and clarifying, and also was sort of half the story. And I like came to understand and realize that when we decrease fear, we have to replace it with something, and that quality is love. And that epiphany about moving from fear to love was just like kind of took over my heart and my life and my thinking. And as I began to speak about it, realized that, wow, this resonates with people. And this was back in 2015, 16, 17, that this resonates in a way that I hadn't anticipated. And it set me on a path to understand the impacts of fear and the impacts of love better, and helping people eventually, you know, doing research and helping people to come to clarity about how damaging and bad fear is in the workplace, just how not helpful fear is, and how really what a great idea creating loving experiences for people are. What a great idea that is. And that became the core of my work and kind of set me on a path to pursuing that more and more and to making it a foundation of everything that I do now. Love has become my work and it will be for the rest of my life.
That's wonderful. So how is that received when you are working with organizations? Is there a, oh, that's so woo-woo love in the workplace? That's almost a dirty word, right? And a lot of
right.
organizations that think it needs to be accountability, it needs to be cost effectiveness or customer service, all those things. How do you navigate that?
Yeah. And I mean, fundamentally, none of those things are not loving, right? I mean, it's how we understand love. So, you know, making sure that people are responsible and encouraging responsibility is loving, encouraging, you know, all the things that you just named, are loving behaviors if they're done in the right way, if they're, you know, done with dignity and respect and can be loving acts for the people that we serve and for the people doing the work. But, you know, like when I say the word initially, there can be like gasps in the room. There can be, you know, kind of what, huh? There can be like the whole range of responses. So some people will be confused. Some people will be shocked. Some people will be sort of angry. A little bit offended, like, you know, shouldn't be talking about that here. And a bunch of people will be like, yeah, okay, now we're talking, and we'll be really positive. And so that's just sort of at first, like at first blush, you know, the first mention of that. And what I have come to realize is that it's important, if I'm going to say the word that, you know, and introduce this concept, that I need to take people on sort of a whole journey through to understand what I mean and why. If I just sort of say the word and leave it there and we all kind of, you know, explore that, or we just sort of roll around in that, like it can get really confusing. But it's important for people to be brought through to understand what is love. What do I mean by that? What do I mean by that in a professional setting? How love manifests in all the different areas of our lives, or we should be aiming to have it manifest in all of the different areas of our lives, and it takes different forms. So not talking about romance and passion, you know, obviously that it's not that kind of love, but there are versions of love that belong in every area of our life. So we have, you know, we experience love in moments with strangers, you know, on an airplane, or I know in a street or in a Starbucks. You know, we can have exchanges with people that are loving, that are filled with human kindness, and we could call that love, and we'll never see those people again. And then we have experiences with our closest people in our lives, and we understand those as loving experiences. But we can also have loving experiences in our neighborhood or in our community or at work. It just looks different. It is embodied in different ways. And so, yeah, people have those responses. And as I help them to understand what I'm talking about and then share my research with them, usually the shoulders kind of drop and people sink into that and realize, oh, and I often hear, oh, that's what you mean. I get it now. Yeah, I want that too.
That's great. So you mentioned your research. Mm-hmm. So something that has always struck me about you when I met you, I think back in 2018-ish, I'm not even sure, 2019. Something that's always struck me though, is how you actually have, this is grounded in actual research and there's data behind it. Would you be willing to share a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm trained as a social scientist. And when I had this, you know, this aha, this epiphany about, you know, that it's, and sort of a thesis, if you will, that that it's important to decrease fear and replace it with love. You know, I looked at literature that was already out there and related literature, and then decided that one of the best things that I could do, that I was sort of drawn to do actually, was to gather my own data. So I, you know, devised a research project, and on Valentine's Day of 2017, started interviewing people and collecting stories of people's experiences of love and of fear at work. So the essential kind of research process is to ask people to tell a story of their selection about a time when they experienced fear at work and what happened and what they did and what others did and what the impacts were on them and on their team and on their customers and on their personal lives and health and well-being and what it meant to them. And then to collect a story, to ask them to share a story about a time when they felt loved at work and what happened, what they did, what others did, what the impacts were, and what it meant to them. And so I think I've done 76 interviews so far, and have workshopped these similar questions more informally, not like within the formal research protocol, but informally have workshopped this with thousands of people around the world. In 10 countries. And so have the formal research stories and then have, heard stories informally. And there are patterns. There are types of stories that people tell and patterns to what fear looks like and patterns to what love looks like and insights about, what it is to make work more loving. And so that's essentially that is what the research is about. And that's what I speak about. And it's really sharing that, kind of taking people through what fear is and how it manifests. And everybody recognizes the fear stories, like it's super familiar to us, unfortunately. And the impacts and the negative impacts and the harm to our work and to what we're trying to accomplish is and to people is clear. And then when I introduce love, it really is the same. It's sort of once that gets demystified and I talk about what those love stories are, those are recognizable as well. And there's resonance. And so, people then can kind of embrace it and realize, oh yeah, that, okay. I want to move toward that myself too.
Yeah. If you could share with our audience, what is it that a human workplace does? So I know you started that organization a few years ago, and if you could tell us what that is all about, what you guys do.
Yeah, so a human workplace is a culture consultancy, essentially. And if I were to break it into a couple parts, my job is to make the business case for love. And then we have a team of affiliate consultants and coaches and trainers from across the US and Canada and the UK who help our clients to operationalize that love in practice. And so that's our work, is to help people understand that love is a good way to work, an excellent way, an important way to work, and putting love at the center of your work is a valuable thing to do. And then we help people understand how to do that.
That's amazing. So you work with public sector clients, private sector clients,
the whole gamut. We work with public, private, nonprofit, all kinds of organizations. And I would say that because my work started in government, we've done a lot of work in government, but also in the public or private sector, excuse me. So, yeah.
And I will say I met you at WICSEC, the Western Intergovernmental Child Support Engagement Council, long name, but I met you back then when we had you in as a keynote speaker. And it was surprising to me how much your message resonated with our mainly government. We have vendors as well, but the bulk of it are our line staff, right? So we have that group of people and how much that resonated with them about understanding fear, not love in the workplace and the importance of changing the culture. And so I've been having a good time over the years watching you. We've had you at WICSEC like a couple times, and then I had you in my own agency doing work with, you came and did work with our staff during the pandemic, right, which was very meaningful and people really loved it. And I mean, there were tears, there were, it was laughter, it was joy, it was all of the emotions, and people really needed that, especially at that time, right? To have an organization who would allow you to give voice to your emotions and treat people like fully formed human beings and not just cogs in a wheel.
Right. I remember all of those engagements both with WICSEC and then with you as in the agency as well. And just what an honor to work with you all. Gosh, I think back to like the first WICSEC conference was online. And one of the things, and I still have it, one of the things, when I'm talking and it was a uniqueness of being online, that when I posed the question, like sharing stories and so on, invited people to share their responses in the chat, what love is, and their examples of feeling afraid at work or feeling loved at work, and people were chatting it away. I came away from that keynote with 40 pages of chat.
Oh my gosh.
40 pages of interaction from that one keynote, and just like voluminous outpouring of people's responses to these questions and like willingness to engage in this dialogue. And certainly like it was alive for us then in a very particular way, you know, in the middle of the pandemic. But I see that in person as well, that whereas, you know, maybe 10 years ago, this would have been pretty radical. It's becoming less radical. I wouldn't call it mainstream yet, but I would call it more and more accepted, and that, you know, we're sort of like over, I think we're over ourselves, like over pretending that, you know, we're going to like come to work and be dehumanized and be okay with that. Like, people are just not having it anymore, and good for them, good for all of us, because when we are dehumanized, like, we can't do our work well. And goodness, we need, you know, we need to all, at the very least, we just need to be able to come in and do what we're hired to do and not have it be so darn hard. We need to not make it hard on each other and on ourselves. But even more than that, like, many people are trying to solve really important problems. And why should we make it hard, you know, to serve and to solve? Like, we shouldn't. So I'm encouraged, you know, by what I see and by that kind of engagement. And yeah, I remember so fondly all of those sessions that we held with your team and their responsiveness, and then the recent WICSET conference too. Just the dialogue, so many dialogues afterwards. And it really, you know, I would say that it has led us to an understanding, and we've done some work with different kinds of social workers and different social work teams at a human workplace, and some kind of studies to test and pilot interventions, if you will, but particularly around well-being. And, you know, maybe I can share a little bit about that. There's this kind of dichotomy that struck me, or this sort of two parts that struck us recently when we think about how, you know, people in their work, you know, are looking to thrive. They're looking to have a good work experience. They're looking to feel good about themselves, you know, reasonably good about themselves at the very least, and to, you know, to do a good job. And, you know, some work that people say yes to is just really hard work. It takes a toll. It's emotionally taxing. It can be traumatic. It can have grief and stress involved. And it's not, you know, that we've made it that way. It's that the work itself is challenging. And I think of many, many kinds of social work that teams do, or that, you know, individuals do, is that way, or first responder work, or, you know, some kinds of public sector, other kinds of public sector jobs that are that way, that the work that someone has felt called to and has said yes to and steps into is just really hard. And when that work is really hard, and stress, you know, is kind of a everyday occurrence, it needs to be processed. People need to move through it and get it out of their bodies and come back into good kind of self-regulation and balance and health. And if we tell people in that kind of work, you know, to like do, here's some resilience practices, go do yoga, meditate your way out of that, like, there's, you know, those can be helpful and valuable, but when the work is so difficult and sort of chronically ongoing, stressful, they need something more. And we've discovered that, you know, just saying you should do self-care is really kind of cruel. And instead, what we've found is that creating a culture of collaborative care, where we are all in it together and we're caring for each other, is the loving thing to do in that kind of work, when the work itself is hard and stressful and traumatic. We need to create a culture of collaborative care. And when we do that, when we build in the sort of the, you know, collective support, when we build in manager support and expectations that people will take breaks, go for walks, you know, do care themselves and in on their teams. When we build stress relief and grief processing into the team and into the employee manager practices or into peer practices, when we create care circles, when we offer training, like when it's like inculcated into the organization, and when we've got like affirming communication coming out, then that environment of collaborative care can help with the ongoing de-stressing and processing trauma that needs to happen. Because it's just not reasonable to say, hey, go take care of yourself, you know? So we found that to be important. And then the second thing is, in complement to that, is when we make the work hard on ourselves by just creating a culture that is where the culture itself is traumatic and where the culture is imbued with fear and is damaging and harmful. In that we've done some work did a study, a kind of in-depth study with a particular organization that revealed these what we call thrive factors. And those thrive factors are sort of states of being that we found people wanted to move towards. So sort of away from confusion and toward clarity, and away from fear and sort of toward away from uncertainty and toward courage. And away from wholeness, or excuse me, away from fractionalization or fracturedness and toward wholeness, and away from being overworked and overwhelmed and toward spaciousness and simplicity, and then away from doubt and sort of overwhelm and toward hope. And so that clarity, courage, wholeness, spaciousness, simplicity, and hope are these thrive states of being that we realize that we can help people achieve. And if when we do that, it's making work that is hard by nature of the work, it's making the way that we do the work better. So we're not, we're not piling on, but instead we're enabling people to feel healthier and that they can thrive and feel loved at work.
Love
That's a
that.
lot, but
That's
that's
all. I love that
all, yeah.
collaborative care term too. I really haven't thought of it in that context before, but it does completely make sense. And
Yeah.
we go to work every day, whether we're online or hybrid or in person, but we are picking up what everyone around us is
Right.
doing and the culture and the tone. And that's so important to be mindful of that.
Well, and gosh, I know that social workers are tend to have a really high standard for themselves and be so committed to clients and often understaffed and overloaded just by nature of funding and all. And maybe, but with turnover and whatnot, that there can be a lot of factors that lead to that. But that sense that I can't take time for myself because I've got this, this urgent needs for my clients, and it's just not sustainable. And yet there is this sort of normalization of that, emotional burden and the, overwhelming workload. And so to the degree that we can help to people to connect and support each other in that, and to adopt processes and practices that balance that out and that help us to process the stress where people are better off, and it's
Yeah.
just more sustainable and more enjoyable.
Absolutely. So important.
Yeah.
So that kind of leads me to the next question that I had, which is, so how do you operationalize this? What are tips or some practical things? Someone's listening to this and they say, yes, this makes a lot of sense for me, my office, or even just my team, right? Some people may be formal leaders in their organizations, some may be informal leaders in their organizations. But what are some, I don't want to say tips and tricks, but to how we bring this into our workplaces or our lives.
Yeah. Gosh, there's so much. Like we could talk for several hours on that. So I'll try to
I
get a
know.
smattering of examples. I mean, I think fundamentally, if I were to lift that question up high, like to the highest level, it's that we need to be able, on the one hand, to meet each other human to human in the moments that matter in our day-to-day work. And this is for leaders, but it's also for team members. I mean, we all are interacting. And so that involves developing our emotional muscle and our capacity to be able to, I would say, hold space for someone else. And that could be, I'm so excited because this happened either in work or in my private life. I had this victory, or here's this sweet thing I'm, really jazzed about, and being able to care about that with someone and just, celebrate that with someone. It could be in those moments where people make a mistake, or where there's a problem or a challenge or confusion, or where they need to admit that they don't know what to do, or There could be any number of things that happen. It could be when they're new on the job, or it could be as they're changing into another role, or there's all these moments, you know, that we could think of in, you know, throughout our lives as people and as employees, where, you know, we engage with each other and we need to be met. We need to be seen. We need to be understood and valued in those moments. And so that takes cultivating some muscle to be with each other and to accompany each other. And if I were to share a quick example, you know, I have a team member, my team member, Rick, who's our COO, he's our compassionate operations officer. And in short, you know, Rick's wife, Rebecca, was diagnosed with cancer. And we knew that she'd been processing and, you know, that, and they'd been, you know, been in treatment and been going, processing the, you know, the emotional experience of that and whatnot. But then he came to us one Monday morning and let us know that she'd taken a turn and that she'd just been given a couple weeks to live. And so we stopped everything in that morning meeting and just met him there and held him and grieved with him and let him express what he needed to express. And as we were doing that, it really struck me that that it was important that Rebecca know and that he know that we had him, that we would take care of him, that we would be with him, and that she could know as she made this transition that he wouldn't be alone and that we would be there for him. And so I let him know that and he let her know that. And then we had the honor of doing that for him. And we have for this last year and a half, year and three quarters now since she passed. And so we've accompanied Rick on his journey of grief, which has been profound for all of us and, you know, challenging sometimes for sure, because there's times when he's just needed to step aside, step out. But that's human, right? That's life. And it's also been incredible to watch him move through his grief and integrate that grief into his life in a really healthy way. And he talks about it as not having to pretend and sort of compartmentalize, but being able to be with it. And he's healthier now because of that. And so what I guess I share that story and that example of sort of how we love each other and meet each other in these moments that matter, you know, looks like that. It looks like, you know, hey, I'm, you know, let's celebrate your thing, but it also looks like we're going to be with you for the long haul. And so that's love in practice in one kind of way. The other thing to think about, so kind of flipping the other side of the coin, is embedding love in our practices and in our processes and in our the way that we describe our purpose and our planning, embedding love in our people practices. And so I think it's a leader's work for sure, and wise to bring a team along to do that, to sort of systematically over time think about what does love look like in all of these different components of our organization that, you know, that we're responsible for. And, you know, I mean, we have a whole assessment about that and, you know, different factors to kind of think through. But if we, you know, if we think about, well, what I found is that it's like intuitive, like we actually know a lot more about this than we would admit or than we might realize. So if I were to say, you know, if you think about your hiring process, what is a loving hiring process, right? How do we design that? The experience for the people who are applying, the experience for the candidates that we interview, the experience for the team that is doing the process of interviewing and hiring. Like if you think about that process, we could go through and systematically think, well, okay, what are the candidates, you know, candidates, like what's that experience and how can we make sure that there's good communication and clarity and, you know, appreciation, that there's timeliness. If there's a gap that we come back and explain, that when people are chosen for a selection process, that it's a humanized process, right? That it's, and so if we were to like deconstruct that, we could outline pretty easily the kinds of practices that would make that more loving. And that is, you know, our work to do. So I'll pause there and see, is that resonating, and what's coming up for you?
Absolutely. Thinking of the hiring process alone or onboarding, but in government specifically, because for so long it felt like, well, you need us. You want your job with us. We're the government. And so we're going to put you through all these probably unnecessary hoops and to get somebody onboarded. And now I think with the kind of change we've seen in the workforce, and sometimes government jobs don't offer the best benefits anymore. We've
Right.
seen the decline in that. So why do these people want our jobs? And it does feel like we need to make it as easy as possible and as welcoming and as loving as possible to get people to want to engage with us, want to come through our doors. And that goes to the clients as well with me, not just even our own
Right. Right.
staff, but got to meet people
Yeah.
kind of where they're at and put ourselves in their shoes.
For sure. It reminds me of a story of there was a team at a state agency that I worked at, and they were a training team. And oh my goodness, I saw them one day, and I saw the manager of the team, and she was so excited because her team had just had this really hard conversation about diversity and inclusion, and about the training content that hadn't gone well, and it surfaced a bunch of concerns. And she was just really thrilled and impressed with the maturity and the quality and the productivity, if you will, of that conversation. And I said, really, like, I'd really like to talk with them and just ask them about that experience and what enabled them to have that conversation. Could I talk with them? Because I'm thinking, that's a conversation, like, those are conversations we're all trying to have. Like, what could we learn from this team? And so I sat down with them and said, hey, I heard this happened. Like, tell me about that. And they started talking about how when they were hired, several of them were hired all at once. There was sort of a beginning team, and then they hired and doubled the size of the team. And when this cohort was hired, he said, they welcomed us on the first day, and the leader greeted us and let us know that we were, they were so glad that we were there. And they let us know that they'd been waiting for us to join the team, so we really felt welcome. And then we went to the cafe and we had coffee and just got to know each other. And I could tell they really, wanted to know who I was as a person. And then this woman said, it became clear that there was like real confusion about where to park, because in this particular state agency building near the Capitol campus, like on the Capitol campus parking garage, was where they were supposed to park, but it was sort of far away, and it was like a labyrinth. It was like so confusing, all these different entries, and where do you go, what level, and all this. And so when the manager heard that they were all confused about where to park, he said, oh, well, let's take care of that. And so he took them all out to his truck, and they got in the truck, and he like drove them out of the parking garage, and then showed them, like, here's where to enter, and here's the level to go to park at, and where to park, and the elevator, and here's the walkway to get to our building. Like, here's the nice, the nice, easy, smooth way to do that and feel safe, and like, where you're going and all that. So he showed them where to park. And all these months later, this woman is saying, like, it was, on our first day, all these experiences, and he showed me where to park, and I knew that I was welcomed and cared about here. And then, they proceeded to do the work. And the thing is that, the reason they were able to have this awesome team experience, they pointed back to that first day on the job, to this essentially loving onboarding experience where the manager took time and did, thoughtful, kind of go the extra mile things to care for them. And it bonded them, and they had this great outcome together. And even today, like, those team members are still close to each other. Many of them have gone on to other jobs, but they are still close to each other. So that's the power of what can happen, when we really take the time to be thoughtful and care for each other in these moments that matter, and in this sort of the practices of our organization.
And it sounds like these are not really things that cost money.
Thank you. Exactly. Isn't that good news? Totally. No, I mean, I think that's one of the huge insights that's actually come out of my research. When I ask people, yeah, none of that costs money. It takes your attention and attention and intention. But it's not a program. There's no budget allocation to that. It's just decide that you're going to, you know, be more human-centered and loving. And you know, when I interview people and they tell me their stories about loving leaders in particular, like all of those stories point back to behaviors that any leader can do, again, that are not programmatic, that are just about how they are showing up and interacting and taking an interest in caring about people. That I think that's good news, right? Especially for, you know, all our friends in public sector work, that we can have a huge impact without needing the legislature or our appointing authority to do anything. I mean, certainly, don't get me wrong. There's lots of things that we, you know, hope appointing authorities will do, but we can still, you know, have lots of impact and influence.
Absolutely, and just applying that lens, that loving lens, to our work internally and externally to the extent that we can.
Yes. So one of the things that I love to encourage people to do, and sometimes do this in workshops and keynotes, is just to ask people to think about whatever challenge they're facing, whatever opportunity they might have. And this could be, you know, they have a one-on-one with someone that they're stressed about or have concern about, or, you know, the team is facing some kind of change, or, you know, there's some new opportunity to grow or do something different and new in the organization. It could be anything. If you name that challenge or opportunity, and then you make a list of the people who are impacted by that challenge or opportunity. And then you make a list on the one side of a sheet of paper or a, you know, a document, make a list of all the things that you could do that would create fear for those people in terms of that challenge or opportunity. Make that list. How could we help them to feel more anxious, more threatened, more worried, more marginalized, right? And make that list. And then make a list on the other side of the document of how we could help them to feel loved. How could we help them to feel included, respected, challenged, like they belong? How could they feel compassion? What would help that to happen? And what I have discovered is that we can make those lists. Like we know, we know. And so if we pause and take the time to make those two lists, then I guess the obvious thing is like, don't do the things on the fear list and do the things on the love list. Don't do the things on the fear list and do the things on the love list. And it's amazing, you know, what can happen if we are just intentional and clear for ourselves about that. And you know, if there's any confusion, we can all also ask people, I really want to make sure that I don't create fear for you and your team or for, you know, you, our constituents or whatever in this situation. I really want to make sure that we don't make this fearful, but instead we make it loving. What would make it fearful? What would, you know, solicit these kinds of experiences and feelings, and what would help you to feel loved and cared about as a human? And they'll tell you, right? And then that's clear. Let's do that then. So
that's even bubbling up for me about our clients and child support. We've had historically a scary reputation where you're not paying your child support, we're going to put you in jail. We're going to do all these things too if you're not paying your child support. And there are certainly consequences for not paying your child support that we need to have those levers of enforcement actions when needed. But I think that really speaks to me as somebody who's been in this industry for so long of how do we treat these people like human beings? Because that's all they are, right? Or just human beings trying to do the best they can and eliminate those barriers. And that to me looks like asking our clients, focus groups, what have you, people with experience, lived experience, to say what would help make this less of a scary, because it's scary.
Totally.
What would make this less of a scary, fearful process for you? And then looking at how, what are the ways that we can tweak our processes for our communications, not even talking about, I mean, greater scale, of course, law changes, et cetera. There's definitely things we have been thinking about in our community. But if you look at what are just the small little things I could do internally in my own organization to make it easier for our clients.
Right. Well, and that's a beautiful example. And with the context wrapped around that, you know, the impact of saying, you know, so by way of introduction, like, we know this is scary. We know that this, you know, comes with a lot of threat and confusion maybe and worry, and We want to do everything we can to make it less so because we just care about you as a human being. We care about your family as a human being. Like, we care about our constituents, our clients, even though I know this seems like sometimes we don't, but we're here to like ask, right? Because we care. And then that act of listening is incredibly powerful, especially, and you know, we know this, right? From people who are disempowered or, you know, who are under threat, like who feel ignored and marginalized, the act of listening is incredibly empowering and uplifting. And you know, if I go back to a definition of love, we didn't really talk about what love is, like what do I mean by love, but one of my favorite definitions of love comes from my friend Moshe Engelberg, who says that love is energy that uplifts and connects. And you know, just the act of asking and listening is an act of uplifting and connecting, and incredibly powerful and affirming. So I think it's a beautiful thing to do.
That's a great definition of love too.
Isn't
really
it
like
awesome?
That.
Yeah. Yeah. We've leaned into that in some ways too, to realize that it's not like uplifting, like, oh, where everything's going to be rosy, you know, because sometimes the thing that is uplifting can be challenging. So one of the things that's become clear in all of this work over the years on love is that there's a lot of nuance involved in learning to lead and team and work and be loving. It's not always obvious and it's not always simple. So, you know, we have to kind of be ready for that, to be ready to face the nuances and challenges, but it is so worth it to do that.
So tell me about Center for a Loving Workplace.
Yeah, the Center for a Loving Workplace, lovingworkplace.org. So we, a year ago, founded a nonprofit with the idea that, you know, we had this community develop within my business, within Human Workplace affiliates, but also leaders that we were all kind of hanging out together, realizing that there was so much potential in this community, and that it needed to move like sort of outside of a business and into a different kind of entity in order to for all of the goodness, if you will, and for all of the possibilities to be explored and released in different ways. So there's certain things a business can do and certain things that a nonprofit can do differently and invite differently. And so we founded the Center for a Loving Workplace last year, and it is a member organization for people to join, to come and discover what it is to put love at the center of work, and then to be involved in advocating and sharing and learning and growing together and bringing that love in the workplace into the world. So that is essentially what it is. And we have lots of visions about what it can be, you know, with research and with demonstration projects and organizations and, you know, lots of things to come. But the beginning here is to come together as people who are committed and believe in this, to affirm this with one another and to learn together and then spread that knowledge and insight out into the world. Yeah, we would welcome folks to come visit and check it out and donate if they're so inclined and support. There's sort of a this time of starting up or, you know, getting things off the ground. We welcome support to do that, and but also just people to come to join and be in community and learn and grow together.
And I find it interesting, as a member of the center myself, I find it interesting that it's also people from all walks of life, all different industries, all different backgrounds, all different ideas to bring to the table.
Yes. Yeah. I'm so glad you found that. And we're aiming to have that be more and more the case, right? To just have that diversity of experience and backgrounds and knowledge to grow and yeah, ways of being. And, you know, people are bringing different things to the party, if you will. So yeah, we're excited to have that community grow.
A wonderful network of people. I will link to that in our show notes.
Great.
To lovingworkplace.org, which is for the Center for a Loving Workplace, and then also a Human Workplace,
great,
which is makeworkmorehuman.com.
Great. You know, one of the things I'd love to offer too, and maybe in all of, if I don't know if we can have a handful of links, we have, and this kind of gets at what does it look like to put this in practice? And like I said, like it's a huge question and there's so much, and we've just kind of touched on examples today, but we have a series of blogs on the invitation to thrive and on that clarity, courage, wholeness, spaciousness, simplicity, and hope. And each of those articles has practical guidance on how to put those factors into practice, which create the context for more love and humanity. So I'm happy to share those and also just welcome people to, you know, send their questions too. And we love to dialogue with folks about what's going on and to like to link up on LinkedIn and be in conversation that way.
That would be wonderful. Yeah, I think people would appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, would love that.
Well, thank you, Renee. I've really enjoyed our chat today, and I'm sure that our listeners have as well. Thank you so much for taking the time today. I really do appreciate you.
Thank you, Veronica. I appreciate getting to share and to share with your audience.
Thank you to our guest today, Renee Smith. We hope you've walked away inspired to act to decrease fear in your workplace and replace it with love. Don't forget to check out the links to Renee Smith and A Human Workplace in our show notes. On behalf of the NCIA On Location podcast, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy our podcast, please leave us a review, subscribe, and remember to tell a friend about us. Have a great day.
On Location is available on iTunes, Anchor, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and anywhere you get your podcasts. We have a lot of great episodes on the way, so be sure to subscribe and listen to all of our previous episodes as well. We also appreciate your ratings, your feedback, your comments, and your suggestions. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, please reach out to us on the contact link on our website. On Location is a production of the NCIA Communications Committee with special production assistance from Joe Mamlin and me. Thanks again for joining me. I'm Tim Leitner, and this has been On Location.